This is Leo for KTWH, Two Harbors Community Radio, and it's been a couple of weeks since we had Michaela Rice in the studio, the naturalist up at Gooseberry Falls State Park. And Michaela, you're back, and it's a wacky day. We've got tremendous winds outside buffeting us on this April 16th at about 40 miles per hour at times. We've had a blackout. The lights have gone off. They've come back on. And here we are. We were getting all ready to have the field recording for Wandering Nature News today. But instead of a field recording, we're back in the studio and appreciate your patience.
I would rather be in the field, but I understand. I'm just kidding. That was the atrium.
Yes, the atrium is a covered space in the Harbor Landing building. Well, it's that kind of April after having some balminess in March and then having a snowstorm. Our pattern just keeps continuing to change. Forecast tonight is the beginning of a really substantial rainfall. And from your observations, wouldn't you say we need some?
Yes. Period.
Oh, full stop.
Just kidding. Yes, full stop. Hard stop. Just lingering that. But yes, we do need the rain. We had some precipitation in the past few weeks. So we refer to rivers as running. When they're running, you know, they're got some water, they're turbid, you know, they're a little bit louder. That also means that maybe in the spring, some other fish are running upstream. It's funny, rivers, fish don't have legs, just means moving.
But fish runs are really music to the ears of the fishermen.
Very important up here.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've had steelhead trout fishermen, women in the rivers in this last week. So that's been really fun to see recreation really pop up at the park, especially since we didn't really have any recreators over the winter. So that's kind of livening up the park. All the animals are pretty much back and waking up now. The last of some of them were the snakes. They were still cold this week, but emerging.
You've seen yourself, your first snake?
Yes,
sighting?
I stepped on one accidentally, and it had already had kind of like a tattered body. I think it looked like a weed whip or something that had already been marred by like last year. Yeah.
Well, in line with reptiles, the amphibians were back in Clover Valley, I think maybe on Sunday, if not Monday morning. So mid-April, first audible frogs in the many wetlands of Clover Valley, and that is not that far off. Typical phenology, although we arrived at that starting date a little differently than others because we thought we were going to have an early start, and then we had a snowstorm.
Yeah.
And they didn't like that.
I think spring would have been a lot earlier if we didn't have that.
Indeed.
That late snow. Yeah, as we have it, things are warming up. And the trees, I don't know if you've noticed, the conifers were so green the last few weeks. I mean, they just really started to pop in the forest. The gooseberry leaves, I didn't know they came out so early, but it's a bush I can pick out really easily right now because it's got these bright green leaves and these really spindly arms of this bush. Then the big ferns are going to start growing. This is the leaf. The leaves are coming out. So it's going to bud and have flowers later. So this is perennial bush, and it's, you know.
But you don't have a name for it, so.
Gooseberry. It's a gooseberry.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, at gooseberry, but no, it's a gooseberry bush that the leaves are coming out.
Okay, and the genus Ribes, I believe.
Ribes, sure,
yep. There you go. Okay, so we've got the gooseberry bush out and leafing. We don't have a lot of other hardwood, trees that are showing quite that sign. We're several weeks away, maybe two or three weeks away from the aspen popping out. Although I could be made wrong by a hot spell coming in, Michaela. But in the meantime, what else are you seeing? We talked about first ephemeral flowers and which would be the first bloom seen. And we haven't seen any in our neck of the woods. How about you?
No, I have seen, I think the crocus I saw was down in the suburbs. I don't know if there's flowers blooming in any gardens in Duluth, but definitely not up the shore. My vote is that the first spring ephemeral found within the park boundaries would be bloodroot. So that's what I'm betting on this year.
Okay, which I believe is a sanguinaria. In the meantime, after we both struggled to think about who would be the first bloomer, I remembered and found at home this lovely book that I would suggest to people is pretty neat. The organization of the flowering plants is by their typical first appearance. And the very first plant that they show that might be blooming is a skunk cabbage. And I didn't do my homework because we don't seem to have skunk cabbage where I am. You don't seem to have them at Gooseberry. I think you might have to go at least a few miles south of Duluth Duluth till it's more common skunk cabbage territory. But the sanguinaria, the hepatica, those are flowers that were listed very early on in the book.
I haven't found hepatica, but the last few springs also haven't produced all the flowers, and I don't know all the parks. So I'm actually kind of going to be putting things out in the visitor center, like help me find which species is blooming first.
I know you said that you didn't have certain of the trilliums, and I think in our area we don't have all of the trilliums that might be found in the Northland, but
yeah, we don't
that's,
have the
that's among the early plants, as well as the hepatica and the bloodroot and something called a bellwort, which is this the simple yellow hanging pendant flower.
Yeah, I've seen that at St. Croix and down in Mankato area. But like in the transition zone maybe, but I don't know if I've seen that up north too much.
So we welcome listeners. You can always email me at thcommradio@gmail.com and give us a nudge if we're missing some of the early arrivals that you're expecting. Let me know.
Locally, and then of course that are from this area.
Oh yeah, I'm not as interested in the non-native species.
Yeah, they just bloom at weird times.
I can note that the rhubarb has aggressive red bulges coming out of the ground. It is ready to fire up stalks.
Wow.
Probably the first 55 degree day after the rain. You give it that rain, give it the sun, and before you know it, it'll be 4 feet tall.
So since we have so many international listeners,
we do indeed.
Can you tell us what rhubarb is and why it's in your garden? I don't have any.
Do you want me to tell you what I know about the evolutionary
history of
rhubarb?
Why people eat it, what it is, what it's good for.
Well, on some menus, they'll actually refer to it as the pie plant.
Oh.
And rhubarb has stalks that are fat like celery, but very astringent and tart because it's full of oxalic acid, which isn't all that great for your kidneys, but in moderation, it's delicious when combined with a little sugar.
A lot of sugar.
Well, there's a lot of argumentation about that because some people, in order to cure themselves of, a lot of people don't like that tartness. Some of us actually eat the rhubarb pies because of the tartness.
Yeah.
And so we go for a low level of sugar, and other people want to completely disappear the tartness in the rhubarb. So they'll put 2 cups of sugar in a pie. And my point of view is that I'll just wait for raspberries.
Yeah. No, I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Oh, thank you. You did it well.
For people who have never had it, and because Western, folks, I have way too much sugar in my diet. I want sweet stuff. So it is just kind of like a, whoa, that's kind of sour.
Yep.
So it's fun to have kids try it for the first time and kind of like watch their eyes.
You can remind me, what am I thinking of? Sweet tarts. It's that very puckery tartness that you get. If you're sitting around eating raw rhubarb, then you are really a true Northlander.
And I think it's hardy up in these areas. So I was hoping you had a fun fact about, people brought it here. But I think it's just a hardy. It overwinters. It comes up early. It's good, nutrition.
Super reliable. Once you establish it, Michaela, it's sort of like you set it and forget it. And it does well by you year after year. If you plant it in moderately fertile soil, you've got yourself a companion perennial for a generation at least.
Sure.
And it does help make neighbors, because neighbors who don't have any can get the divisions of your rootstock and start their own rhubarb. But then, of course, they don't have to come over to your place to eat pie with you because they can make their own.
Speaking of sharing in communities, spruce budworm is spread through sharing. It kind of is. So
I don't know where you're going with that.
So I'm thinking of movement and things kind of spreading, and we're kind of learning about this last infestation of spruce budworm kind of in our area, right?
Yeah.
It's been in the area for 8 to 10 years, and I don't personally know the ecology of how the pests are spread, but they take over large areas, right? And it spreads.
And it's a cyclical infestation.
Yeah.
No one can really tell me whether it's on a really tight cycle, like they say cicadas are, like a 17-year cycle. No one's been able to tell me what exact cycle these are on. But this last time was by far the worst infestation that I've seen any evidence of in our woods. I mean, when we moved to our land in 1989, there was evidence that there had been an infestation of spruce budworm within the last decade, but it was very spotty. This is landscape-wide, this last infestation. That's what I'm curious, is whether there's any conclusions as to why this has been such a pernicious event. It's been just everywhere.
Yeah, I think a lot of what information is coming out right now is that drought, unfortunately, plays a very big role in the susceptibility of trees with spruce budworm. So when we think of disease spread, we can think of factors affecting the pest, right? Things that might help them spread. But in this case, the trees can't really fight back because they don't have the water and the resources to make their anti-pest compounds. Those, okay. They're called secondary metabolites. Trees are constantly making those, and it helps them fight off infections, fight wounds. But when they don't have a lot of water, they got to cut their budget, right?
Sure.
And they can't afford to make those compounds that keep away these pests. So that's why I think these big plots. Also, since we haven't had fire in our land practices, we get these big plots of kind of all the same age cohort of trees. And that makes them really susceptible to stuff like this as well.
So that's the age class, and that's the tree side of the equation. My observation was that for 4 or 5 years, we had very high numbers of the pest. You can remind me what the spruce budworm actually is. Is it a caterpillar that turns into a moth?
Yeah, you could call it kind of their adult or their lean stage, their
feeding
stage.
I would say that they were profound numbers. So something was perhaps accelerating population of the insect and making it hard for the tree to mount its defenses, kind of like a worst case scenario.
Well, yeah, and when you have all this food to feed off of, your larval populations are going to do really well too. It can support a high number of insects, right?
Yeah.
When that so much of the tree is available to be eaten. So that could also have impacts.
We find ourselves in another cheery topic. Sometimes we're talking about the effects of climate change. Climate change may be a factor in that drought or the numbers of insects because of more favorable environment for overwintering. There's so many things, but I know that other similar tree affecting organisms like gypsy moths are now feared in our neck of the woods, and they haven't been before. But where I grew up in the East Coast, gypsy moths were the thing to worry about, and they would wipe out huge acreages of hardwood forests at a time. It seems like there are an awful lot of things that could make things go wrong in our northern forests these days. What's going right, I guess, is a question.
Yeah, I could at least applaud all the efforts that all the land managers, forest managers, local landowners too. I know a lot of people who have been planting trees, right? There
Absolutely.
Is a big community effort to restore trees, forests. Now there's a lot more information, and seems like some local programs, right, to get trees into the hands of landowners. And so that is something that we can really applaud.
Absolutely.
And put our
And just so you know, Michaela, our local Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District is all in on trying to get rehabilitation, clearing off the landscape of the downed and tipped over and entangled, mostly balsam fir and spruce, so that the replanting can be successful. Because when you can't even find the ground because the old forest is now in a tangle, you can't even reach the ground to plant. So that has to be cleared, and then the trees need to arrive at the right time and people need to be available to plant them. And they're working on that. They've got a number of grants that they've just taken applicants on, and they'll be funding this year and next year for planting. Focus on the riparian zone, but in other places too. And I'm hoping to have one of the coordinators from Soil and Water come on and tell us about those grants that have already, you know, the window has passed. People had to apply by March 30th, but there are apparently other opportunities to keep finding funds to do that replanting. It's really important stuff.
I would like to get us connected with a forest health specialist too that could come on and maybe talk about some local stuff to Two Harbors.
Yeah. Well, in that regard, the North Shore Forest Collaborative is an organization that's working to get foresters to go to lands that are within a certain distance of Lake Superior Basin or in the Knife River watershed itself to do walkthroughs with the landowners and talk about what they would prescribe for their best approach to reforesting.
That's great.
Yeah. So that's neat news. So you're right. I shouldn't have been so cynical about what's going right. And I know that also that the county and the state have had a concerted effort to try to ward off the spread of the gypsy moth, for instance. I don't know if you've known that they've been doing these. I don't know if they're pheromone, but they're trying to do a prevention that prevents mm-hmm. them from reproducing and spreading.
Yeah, and they are actually changing the name to spongy moth.
Yes, and I'm behind the curve on yeah. that, obviously.
Yeah, so that's what a lot of the material is going to say now is spongy
Thank
moth.
Thank you. But now people yep. know that, you can
You're still talking
those.
About the same yep. same invasive insect. No, we got to be aware of both the doom and gloom and all the stuff that the community is trying to do, so that's great.
It is pretty positive. And before we went on the air, we were still recovering from walking around in the dark in here during the blackout. I was showing you on my cell phone a group of turkeys crossing a road near the Superior Hiking Trail, one of which was much different looking than the others and much lighter in its feather coloration. And you had an interesting observation about what seems to be happening in turkey populations.
Well, the only reason I know this is because there's the same phase. I'm going to call it a leucistic phase because it's not a turkey with albinism. Okay. It's not an all white turkey.
That was something that came to mind, a phenotype that's rare.
Yeah. So it's a little bit in the middle. I've heard some local folks talk about how they actually have themselves incubated Eastern turkey eggs that they bought and put them out in the wild. So there could be how many folks within the last 40 years on the North Shore releasing Eastern turkeys. Some of those eggs, I'm sure, have these leucistic or different morphs of turkeys. You can buy those big white toms for your farm. They're still, the turkey species.
So ecologically, is this a benign thing or do you have some concerns?
Well, you could be concerned for the turkey because if you are a predator, that's a pretty easy turkey to see. For the turkey population, is it harmful? Absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they might be, their genetics might not be durable. They might not last for generations.
They are decorative turkeys trying to compete with those big old males that you showed me. So
yeah. And having that coloration, probably not an excellent way of standing out in general for long-term survival.
Probably not the way that they want to stand out, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Stand out for something else. We should return and end maybe talking again about what's happening this summer at Gooseberry with your big celebration, Waves of Change 2024. What else can you tell us about that? You brought me a nice info sheet.
Here. Yeah, so I'm working on my event planning, but this is the Saturday, the day before Lake Superior Day. So we are having a big party at Gooseberry. The shore will be having a handful of programs. It feels like a ton. of events on Sunday. We are having our party on Saturday, but I really wanted to get folks excited about the movie showing, the free movie showing. We're going to have 3 showings. I will have more details every time I'm on the radio about this event, but we will have 3 free showings of The Sea of Change, a recent documentary that was put out.
I believe, isn't this the Twin Cities PBS folks that did this?
Yep.
And one of our illustrious volunteers here at the radio station, Katja Gordon, I believe was part of that production. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward. And I haven't had a chance to see it, so this is exciting.
Yeah, a lot of local people are involved and local people wanted to see it. So we said, let's try to show it at the park. We're doing it for this event. There's going to be a lot of other free activities throughout the park. And information's going to be released and we'll have some news releases coming out to make sure everyone knows what's going on, where to be, when. But just tell people if you have people looking for something to do, July 20th.
Fantastic.
All day.
Saturday, July 20th. And that being a few months away, Michaela, do you have any ongoing soon-to-happen events that you wanted to highlight before we sign off?
So Jackie Fallon is coming the 20th of April from 1:30 to 3:30.
All right.
So
this Saturday.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Come for her and she'll be in the theater. It'll be something nice to do even if it's crazy outside because she's inside with her birds up close and personal. And then you can check the Parks and Trails event calendar for my kind of randomly assorted programs throughout the next month. Then I'll be onboarding interns and then we will be doing program just full going, every day.
Okay, they're random and assorted, but they can be found systematically by going to the...
Yeah. yeah, on the calendar.
Minnesota State Parks events calendar.
Yep. I'm just saying, some are on Mondays, some are on Wednesdays.
Means you're busy. Means there's a lot happening.
Right? Yeah.
It's that season again.
It is. Yep.
I know that you've got a plenty on your plate, and thanks for hanging out with us a little longer than usual because of having to do some adjustments to where we're going to do the interview. So we're ending up in the studio, and I'm glad to have had you, and we'll see you on the radio again. Hopefully, I guess it's maybe the day before May starts. The day before May Day, we would be back. See you then on the radio if we can.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Michaela. That is Michaela Rice. She is the naturalist up at Gooseberry Falls State Park, and this is Leo for KTWH.